and welcome to the Partners in FinCrime podcast in association with FSCom. My name's Evan McGugan.
And I'm Chris Vaughan.
In this podcast series, we'll be looking to discuss all things anti-financial crime.
We'll be deep diving into cutting-edge stories, as well as other interesting topics in the financial crime space.
In this episode, we discuss FINMA's recent report into risk analysis at Swiss banks. Hey Chris, how's it going?
Yeah, I'm good. Not too bad. How's things?
Yeah, not too bad. Thanks, not too bad. I was just down in Dublin the weekend past watching Ireland beat England in the rugby, so that was good. Did you watch
it? Very nice. I didn't actually, no. I'm not a big rugby person. I do like rugby, but yeah. I think Ireland are going to have a good World Cup. I hope so, anyway.
Yeah, we can only hope. I think it's the hope that kills you, though, so let's sort of temper our expectations. But it is looking relatively positive. What have you been up to?
Yeah, not a lot to update you on, to be honest, mate. World of crypto has been going a bit crazy over the whole travel rules stuff, which obviously we just covered in our last episode. Yeah, it's a crazy time for the industry right now, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting month or two. I'm sure we'll be getting a bit of work coming our way, perhaps, with respect to travel rule compliance. But I have to say, I really enjoyed that podcast last. Really enjoyed having Jason on, and I guess we're sort of at the time of recording as well, coming to the end of the consultation period, right? So it's all getting quite heavy.
That's right. Yeah. So the JMLSG consultation ended on the 25th, which obviously that will close out, and then the implementation date is the 1st of September. That's the deadline for compliance. Obviously, we know that the FCA has been reaching out to a lot of firms around this and asking more questions, sort of making sure that firms are ready, I suppose. Yeah, it's busy. It's crazy with the travel rule. I think the complexities are just such that I do think, you know, it was a great discussion with Jason. It was really great to sit down and go through it, but perhaps at a bit of a higher level when you really get down into the nuts and bolts of some of the pieces that are in there and the implications for operationalizing the travel rule, it does get, you know, quite complex. But anyway, go back and listen if you haven't listened, because that is a really good episode. Let's do some self-promotion there.
Agreed. I think it'll be quite interesting too. I'm not sure if I know the answer to this question. I don't know if you do, but with the consultation closing on 25th of August and, you know, the date by which firms need to be complying with the travel rule being the 1st of September, are we expecting any update from HMT on the consultation before or from JMLSG before the 1st of September, or is it likely to be after? I know sometimes these things follow beyond the date by which we're meant to obviously comply. Have you seen anything, or is it just out in the air?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything other than the FCA statement that came out around their expectations, which was actually shortly after the release of our podcast. Didn't say anything particularly unexpected, I don't think. Nothing that would immediately refute anything that we said on the podcast. So hopefully everything still stands. But yeah, it's that's really the current position, I think, and that's as much as anyone knows.
Yeah, fair play. And that is the main thing. Yeah, it would have been particularly galling if the FCA had immediately called out our statements on things.
So I suppose we better get on to some FinCrime talk. We've got a new topic for this week, moving on from the crypto stuff for the time being. I'm sure that'll come back around. What's on the docket?
Yeah, so I guess there's been one big thing over the past week or two, top of the news, sort of trending at the moment, is a pretty scathing review of the state of money laundering risk analysis within the Swiss banking system. The sort of long and short of it there is FINMA, so the Swiss Financial Market Supervisory Authority, has essentially went and found out that many of the 30 banks that they quite recently assessed were falling down in probably what you'd call pretty spectacular ways with regard to the way that they conduct risk analysis of the money laundering risks that are essentially inherent in their business. So I think that could potentially be quite a good one to jump into, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. Saw this jump out. Of course, Swiss regulator, Switzerland, the number one country for wealth management. So it is, as you say, it's a relatively scathing piece, and I think it'll be interesting to jump into some of the pieces in there in a bit more detail. Risk assessments, risk analysis is a favourite of mine. So yeah, let's unpack that, shall we?
Good stuff. And yeah, always important to note as well. But and I guess the, you know, FINMA sort of call this out in their report as well. But everything starts with a risk assessment and a risk appetite and so on. So if you get that wrong, everything else can sort of fall down. So I think this will be quite a good one to sort of go through. And there's actually some very interesting case study examples that I've wrote down from the report. So if you'll indulge me at points in this, I may refer to them.
Yeah, 100%. That sounds great. We can tackle it. So broadly speaking, then, you know, maybe contextualize the report. What did the report look at? And then we can get into some of the findings as well, I suppose.
So yeah, essentially what FINMA went and did was conduct a broad sort of thematic review, I guess you'd call it in FCA terms. They obviously conduct these thematic reviews from time to time. FINMA went and did their own on the state of money laundering risk analysis in the banks that they regulate and supervise. They went and did this on the back of what they perceived as repeated shortcomings, which they identified during their sort of BAU on-site supervisory evaluations, which, you know, they'll conduct on a regular or periodic basis. And it essentially identifies a number of findings under a number of key headers, and that's the likes of risk tolerance, risk appetite, but also risk assessment, and then associate sort of MI that would go alongside evidencing that your risk framework is effective. So maybe the first one that we could sort of jump into is what the report called risk tolerance, or probably for us, what we'd more refer to that as is risk appetite. It's obviously going to be and is much the same in the UK as it is in Switzerland. In Switzerland, and this will be my first quote of the podcast, a bank must capture, limit, and monitor, among other things, its money laundering risks. So very similar sort of position as to what firms need to do in the UK. FINMA notes that a limitation of these risks, so how you stop these risks from manifesting, requires an adequate definition of a firm's risk tolerance or risk appetite. So that's the first initial sort of failing that they found. They found it to be pretty absent or lacking in some of the banks that they assessed. And there's some pretty interesting case study examples here. So if you'll indulge me, I'll read out a couple, and then maybe we can digest them a bit and then maybe think about what went wrong and what good looks like.
Yeah, go for it.
Cool. So number one, with respect to risk tolerance, they say, quote unquote, typically the deliberate inclusion of certain countries, client segments, services and or products, brackets, e.g. PEPs from certain countries, is a necessary part of an adequately defined risk tolerance. However, in the assessment, such exclusions are often missing from the examined risk tolerances. Number two, in most cases, there is also no suitable process to allow for exceptions to the defined risk tolerance in individual cases, i.e. exceptions to policy process. Such exceptions are to be granted by the executive board after appropriate risk mitigation measures have been defined, and they're to be monitored by the board of directors. And three, another finding was that no key risk indicators were defined that could be used to monitor compliance with the risk tolerance and also enable the executive board of directors, senior management to supervise this on a regular basis. The definition of the key risk indicators can be based on the risk limits defined in the risk analysis. So there's three things there with respect to risk tolerance, risk appetite, talking about definitions in it, exclusions from it, as well as exception processes, lack thereof, and also MI and monitoring to go alongside that. What would be your read on that? What does that sound like to you?
Yeah, I think that it's sort of no real surprise. These are tough things to get right. I suppose they are common findings and common deficiencies that you see at firms. Perhaps it is surprising that it's 30 banks that are having these kinds of issues. I'd say particularly with regards to so risk appetite often, well, should really come after risk assessment. You would obviously analyze and understand the risks that are posed in the first instance, and then from that you use that assessment to build your risk tolerances and your risk appetite, which I suppose are interchangeable words there. The piece I think that FINMA are pushing towards here is when you carry out a risk assessment that is a business-wide risk assessment that obviously takes into account a number of different risk factors and different risk categories, let's say, you'll end up with a certain number of risks that are either outside of appetite, or there'll be pieces where you'll have to form a position, the firm's position on a certain, you know, number of risks as to whether they're going to accept them or not accept them. So that, I suppose that's what it's saying by tolerance. I feel like I'm not really describing that particularly well, but what I mean is, you know, in the examples given, countries client segments, for example, there are probably going to be sectors, potential customers who you just might not want. And it's about identifying what those are, first of all, in the first instance, from a risk perspective, and then making the decision and building the firm's risk appetite around those decisions and being able to stand on it and evidence it. And then obviously to make sure that it becomes part of policy and practice for the business. Countries is a fairly simple one as well. Once you've done a country risk assessment, there are hopefully going to be countries in which you just say no to when it comes to country of residence or transactions to and from and things like that. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, agrees. I was sort of doing a bit of supplementary reading once I'd finished this report and saw another report from 2021 where FINMA essentially came down quite hard on a few Swiss banks who turned out to be involved in the provision of services to Venezuela, to sort of stick to the topic of countries. Obviously, like an area of the world with sanctions exposure and pretty significant OFAC US sanctions exposure in particular. I think as it sort of turned out in that case, several banks were sort of involved in presumably laundering the proceeds of corruption in relation to Venezuelan, you know, embezzlement, but also doing business with PDVSA, the state-owned oil company. So I guess I don't know if these two are connected, but you could sort of see how you have this report today or this week that's talking about how the risk appetite statements that they evaluated didn't even exclude certain countries from risk appetite. And then two sort of years earlier, you have a large number of Swiss banks breaching their obligations with respect to Venezuela. In the absence of a risk appetite statement that sets out where you can and can't do business, you could easily see how it might end up that you end up servicing a Venezuelan company or an intermediary to the oil company or whatever the case may be. If you don't have that at the outset, then best of all in the world, how would people know that you're not able to do that internally?
Exactly. And that usually in a firm will take the form of a risk appetite statement, which would be, you know, the elucidation of your risk appetite in a formal document that would be board approved, that sets out the firm's approach when it comes to risk for these kinds of things. And as you say, that would include countries. You know, there are certain countries you wouldn't want to service, and then it'd include products and services, certain customer segments, et cetera, et cetera. The list goes on. It really depends on the nature of the firm, I suppose, and what you're offering. But yeah, I don't know if there's any sort of best practice pieces there. I mean, obviously, risk assessment should come first. I mean, that makes sense. But when it comes to actually building out a risk appetite statement, what do firms need to consider?
Yeah, I guess it's sort of a tough one. You don't want to put the cart before the horse, for want of a better phrase. So, some of those points maybe seem quite obvious that, you know, well, obviously, you know, North Korea is outside of risk appetite. We don't necessarily need to do a risk assessment for that. Although, I guess you are assessing the risk in an inherent sort of way by just knowing that. So yeah, I guess, you know, and we'll come on to it in a wee bit when we talk about what you should be doing as part of a whole firm risk assessment, but you're going to want to consider your operating model, consider your business, consider what you do, what your transaction flows are, consider what the exposures are there, consider how your controls can potentially mitigate it, and thereafter, where you identify that maybe your preventive or directive controls aren't able to mitigate some level of risk, that is what you would deem to be outside of risk appetite. So I guess that's the exercise that you'd ultimately have to undertake, right? And as you say, document it, make sure everybody's aware of it. And sort of to this point as well on that FINMA report, best of all in the world, risk appetite is a bit of a static document. You can make exceptions to risk appetite. You can make exceptions to risk tolerance in certain circumstances, insofar as risk appetite can sometimes be based on quite broad perceptions and you'll feel actually in this instance, we can mitigate the risk. You should obviously only make exceptions to risk appetite or tolerance when you think you can. But FINMA calls out there being no process to allow for exceptions. And I don't know if I read into that there was no process and so the exceptions didn't happen, or there was no process and as such they were just happening all the time. I assume it was probably the latter.
Yeah, if you don't set out a risk tolerance, then there can't really be an exception because there's no standard by which to measure yourself by, if you see what I mean. There's the knowing how to do it, but then there's the doing it, and it, as you said, there's things to consider to put into it, but it really varies firm to firm, and it will vary depending on the firm's MLRO even and what they're prepared to accept, I guess, and senior management in particular. Obviously they all need to be involved in those kinds of decisions. Perhaps we can do risk analysis then next, because I think you've got a few more insights from the document, and then we can perhaps pull that apart a bit.
Yeah, definitely. So part two of this report relates a bit more wholly to what we would call, you know, AML CTF, whole firm risk assessment, or business-wide risk assessment, or enterprise-wide risk assessment, or, you know, whatever term you like. Again, in the UK, you know, banks in Switzerland are required to assess their inherent risks, sort of consider their controls and designate a residual risk and so on. Again, in this report, the FINMA essentially found some of these banks to be lacking, and a few of these examples are as follows, if I'll just pull it up. And some of these are actually quite interesting, and certainly things that you'll recognize, Chris, from audits, and probably a lot of people listening will recognize as well. So number one, it was regularly noted that the assessments regarding the inherent risk and the control risk, as well as the resulting net risk, or what we would call residual risk, were not broken down individually and comprehensively for each recorded money laundering risk of each money laundering risk category. Furthermore, not all money laundering risks relevant to the institution were always covered. What do you think of that one?
Yeah, so far so good. I think that are quite basic things to get wrong, would we say?
Yeah, you might say that. Agreed. Number two, in order to understand the impact the risk mitigating measures, so control risk effectiveness, have on the inherent risks, they must be described in sufficient detail. However, the description of the risk mitigating measures taken by the institutions were regularly too generic to comprehend their impact on the inherent risks. To demonstrate their effectiveness, key figures, findings regarding the effectiveness of the controls carried out, controls of controls, etc., should be used for this purpose. Now, I know, you know, this will probably be one that will sort of get you going, Chris. Control effectiveness and how that works into an effective whole firm risk assessment. Have you seen this before? Generic breakdowns of controls implemented to mitigate a certain risk?
Yeah, that is in a word is the answer. Yes, I think sometimes you even see assessments where the controls haven't been taken into account or elucidated at all. So you will sometimes see an assessment that is only an assessment of inherent risk with no consideration of control, which essentially means that you can't provide a position on residual risk because you're not clear on what the controls are. to me, that's an incomplete assessment. That's not a real fundamental understanding of the risk still posed after the controls have been applied. So yes, you do see these flaws. I'm sure you yourself have seen them a number of times as well. Both quite sticklers for whole firm risk assessments, maybe.
Yeah, agreed. So what is, I guess maybe this is a good opportunity to consider maybe, well, what certainly what bad looks like, but also what good looks like. In your view, how would you see, what's best practice, I guess, when it comes to detailing your control framework and detailing their effectiveness? Is it good enough just to say, you know, the risk is that we will facilitate money laundering, the control is CDD, so the residual risk is low? Or is there a better way of doing that? And if so, you know, what would you tie that to? How would you make this all sing?
Yeah, 100%. So you've struck upon something that's quite difficult to get to the nuts and bolts of and can be very much case by case. But I'll start by, rather than best practice, I'll start with what's basically required. Okay. So Regulation 18 of the MLRs in the UK, and I'll stick to the UK for now, but it looks very similar across the EU and Switzerland as well, by the looks of it. The Regulation 18 of the MLRs requires you to carry out a business-wide risk assessment of risks that are of money laundering, terrorist financing, and now proliferation financing risks, yep. Which is relatively new and is worth mentioning. And those risks must be, there are certain risk factors that have to be considered in what you might call risk categories. So you have to consider factors that are related to your customers, risk factors that are related to your geographies. Usually that's geographies of operation, I believe the actual wording is, but geographies in general is perfectly fine. Products and services, transactions, and delivery channels. And those are the five categories that any financial crime risk assessment should be looking at least, let's say. You then have to consider the size and nature of the business. Mm. And you also have to take account of things like the national risk assessment in the EU. When we were part of the EU, and I think in the EU, I think you also have to consider the supranational risk assessment, which is an EU level one as well, very often. You also have to take into account anything that any guidance or information that you might see from the FCA as well. So that's stipulated as well. So you're kind of left with a very broad sort of vague set of regulations, I suppose, for business-wide risk assessment. Obviously, you've got JMLSG to go have a read of, which should give you a bit more guidance. But to be honest, best practice is quite, you know, difficult. You're not just going to come to the correct answer by reading the regulation, that's for sure. And it certainly leaves firms with a bit of a gap of knowing what actually they should do next. However, you know, we can talk best practice perfectly straightforwardly. So the first thing is obviously to identify those risks. Best practice of doing that is really to make yourself as expert as possible on at least those five categories within your business. You should know exactly who your customers are or are intending to be. Geographies of operation, product services, transactions, delivery channels, those are all sort of self-explanatory. Perhaps delivery channels is a bit less well understood. Yeah. Do you want to perhaps speak to that one?
Yeah, certainly. So I guess at quite a high level, the delivery channel risk is the risk inherent to the way that your customers come to you. Is that the best way to put it? So the best way to think about it in a simple example would be the difference between an entity which conducts face-to-face business and non-face-to-face business. So take an online only non-physical branch, e-money institution versus a credit union that only deals with people face-to-face. The delivery channel risk and the risk that underlies it is that, you know, when not conducting face-to-face business, there is an increased likelihood of impersonation fraud and so on. Whereas, you know, obviously, if you're meeting somebody in person, it's a lot easier to cross-reference them against their passport and have that level of anti-impersonation control. So that's just one facet of it, I suppose, delivery channel risk. There is others, but in a broad sense, delivery channel risk is how you assess the risk that's posed by the manner in which your prospects come to you.
Exactly. Yeah. It's how I always say it's how clients interface with the firm. So it's like the medium of interface between a firm and the client. So that can even be things like an ATM, for example, because that's actually your products and services being used via an interface that is a, you know, let's say if you've got a card product, that should be considered as well. If you've got an app that customers can access on rather than, you know, face to face, for example, or on a web browser, there are different risks associated with those from all sorts of different perspectives. Security, not least sort of cybersecurity as well. So yeah, delivery channels, exactly, that's what it is. I think the others are really self-explanatory, but delivery channels does sometimes need a bit more explaining. So back to best practice, I suppose, then. So what we'd really expect to see is risks to be identified in these categories, phrased as a risk as well. That's something that you sometimes don't often see. Sometimes you'll see it done differently, actually. Sometimes you'll see firms posing questions within their risk assessments. Sometimes you'll see it as statements, but I always like to see it phrased as, what is the actual risk? Like, we should really be clear about what the risk is. And then there needs to be an assessment of that. Many firms will take sort of a scoring approach. It's very, very common to see impact and probability. And then those scored and either added together or sometimes times together to really get into the nitty gritty. There are differences if you do that on outcomes. So all of these are decisions that you have to take purposefully and with intent, knowing why you're taking that decision as part of your assessment and why you're deciding to go about the assessment in a certain way. But yeah, so you'll have that would be the inherent risk posed to you, and it should be based on all sorts of data points and what you're actually going to do. If you've not started business that yet, then it should be based on business plan and all of the details that will come out of being an expert on what your firm does and the products it offers, and who it's targeting and all that good stuff. So then controls, I suppose. I've been rambling a bit, so perhaps you can take controls.
No worries. Yeah. So I guess once you've went and identified that inherent level of risk which faces your business, based on those risk factors and the regulations, what you want to do then is sort of identify all the controls that you have in place that may work towards reducing the likelihood of any of those risks ultimately manifesting. So, you know, I sort of mentioned CDD earlier, that's an obvious one, but there's a whole range of preventive and detective controls that you should be identifying as those key controls that work towards the mitigation of inherent risks ultimately manifesting. Get them all down on paper, identify which are more important than others, if you can weight it in some regard as well, to determine, for example, you know, take the inherent risk of facilitating a payment inbound from a sanctioned individual or entity. You'll want to think about what controls you have in place to stop that from happening. So you'll have your policies and procedures, which are in place to let everybody know what they have to do. You'll have CDD, which is obvious. You get to know who your customer is, but also if you're talking about a corporate customer, you may have other sort of sub-controls in there, like industry risk assessments, and one industry might be more likely to be predisposed to sanctions risk than the other. So CDD will sort of be in there, but neither of those will be as important as payment screening or sanction screening or that. So you're going to want to take each risk, identify the key controls that are there to mitigate the likelihood of those risks manifesting. And then in a similar exercise as to what you set out for the identification of inherent risk profile, you want to take that same likelihood versus impact sort of matrix and designate a residual risk, which is your perception of what the risk is after you've applied all these mitigating controls. And I guess to tie it back to this FINMA report now, it sort of sets out how that's all quite generic and they weren't necessarily tied in such a way as to demonstrate controls effectiveness. So in one sense, you know, you can go and detail the fact that you have these controls, but But the key point is you also need to be able to demonstrate that you not just have the controls that should mitigate the risk, but also you need to be able to demonstrate some sort of understanding as to how these controls effectively mitigate the risk. And I guess you can tie that into your compliance monitoring framework as well, and tie those two things together, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that is real best practice, is where you see a firm that's got a compliance monitoring plan that informs its assessment and the quality of its controls. Because how are you going to understand how your controls are performing over time unless you actually assess them on a regular basis and you have metrics by which you're assessing them and you've decided what the success sort of fail criteria would be for those tests, how often you're going to conduct them, who's going to do the testing, all these kinds of things, you know, built into a good compliance monitoring plan. The outcome of that should really inform the assessment of controls effectiveness. 100%. One thing I just wanted to touch on as well, because you mentioned there a couple of types of controls, and it might be worth just perhaps explaining what you meant. So I think you mentioned detective and preventive controls. So both really, you know, important types of controls, but we should understand what we mean there. So preventive would be a control that actually stops something from occurring. So for example, you know, perhaps a payment block or something like this that actually prevents a risk manifesting, whereas detective would be just identifying if the risk is manifested. So for example, you could say sanction screening. Sanction screening isn't stopping you from doing business with a sanctioned person unless you actually take action in response to the detective control, if that makes sense. There's actually a couple of other types of risks as well. So there's directive, which points you in a direction, let's say. It guides action. So that would be something like a policy and procedure. You could consider that to be a directive control. And then corrective. So that would be something that would actually correct a risk manifestation that actually took place. So I'm sure you can think of examples, but yeah, those are a few ones to think about. And I think that's important when you consider in the controls as well. We're not expecting every single risk assessment to have identified all these types of controls, but, you know, it's good to know what good looks like nonetheless, is it not?
Agreed. Yeah, it's really good, actually. Good catch on defining those points. And to bring it back to, I think, what you said at the beginning of this whole firm risk assessment part of the discussion, but this has to be appropriate to the size and nature of your business as well. So, you know, whilst we may be going down a bit of a rabbit hole here in what the loudest singing and most active dancing risk assessment might look like, and it is certainly good practice, but, you know, these things can get unwieldy.
Well, certainly the application matters more than the it's all well and good having an assessment with bells and whistles if you don't act on it or design your controls correctly. And that's the other thing I was going to mention, actually, is that your assessment should inform how you design the controls, because you don't just build, or perhaps let's say you shouldn't just build blanket controls. They should be designed to address the risks that you've actually identified, the inherent risks that exist in the environment. So it never happens like this in practice, but realistically, that sort of theoretically rather, that should be how it happens. It should be identification, assessment, and then build the controls, and then obviously ongoing from that, you then have controls effectiveness, and then you can build your risk appetite from that as well. So that's how it sort of goes back full circle.
Agrees. And then I guess I'll ask a slightly leading question here. Firms need to do this when they're starting up a business and never again, or, you know,
I think if they just do it once and then never touch it again, that's great. No. Of course, this needs to be reviewed regularly, but please go ahead and tell us what the quote is. I'm desperate to hear.
Yeah, so this is something that I guess we still might occasionally see in audits. I don't think we see it as much as we used to, but quote unquote number three: often the changes in risks, inherent risks, control risk, and net risks compared to the previous year were not apparent or comprehensible in the risk analysis, although these helped determine the measures needed to manage and monitor the risks. So essentially, that whole chestnut of, you know, we did our risk assessment, which, you know, we all say the expectations of the FCA and so on is it's a live document, and quite right, if there's a significant change to your product offering or delivery channel, as we were saying earlier, you know, you should be updating it, or if there's a change to the outside external environment, you should be changing it too. But you know, you do occasionally see if you've done your risk assessment in February 2022, February 2023 rolls around, you sort of feel like, well, probably, you know, not much has changed. So open up the Excel spreadsheet, save as, you know, 2023, and then you've got your new one for the year. Probably not best practice.
Probably not. No. I suppose we would want to see it reviewed on a regular basis, and then in response to developments as well. So if you were to, for example, start offering to a new customer sector, or you were start offering services in a new country, or you were to start offering a different type of product and service entirely, all of those things, that should be a cue for you if you were an MLRO to say, we need to have another look at this assessment. All sorts of changes like that should have probably their own risk assessments, just to understand if that's even something that the firm wants to do in its own right. But if the decision is made to do something like that, then it should be taken account of in the business risk assessment as well. To be honest, we don't always see it like this, but I these days think it should be a live document pretty much, because it really does. It should be constantly consulted, and it should really be the starting point and the Bible for the whole compliance framework.
Agreed. And I think that there's maybe a good example in the report of how Venma might like to see people use it as a live document. They talk about, you know, well, we talked about control effectiveness, and obviously that's one thing to lead into an actual data-driven whole firm risk assessment, but equally, like, client data, key figures, active client populations, take country, for example, like feeding that in, country exposures to your whole firm risk assessment, rather than just having it be, you know, X risk in quite an intangible regard. Feed what live data you can into this to really reflect not just your perception of your operating environment, but the actual facts of your operating environment. And if you were doing that, then it would be a live document, because you'd essentially have to update it every month to put, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing actually was interesting. It's quite concerning, I suppose, to hear in the report that they weren't comprehensible, which, you know, that's something to consider. These are documents that can't, well, certainly in the MLRs, the FCA by law can request to see your regulation 18 business-wide risk assessment at any point. So the fact that it can be requested by your regulator, it should be completely comprehensible to a third party, and that should be in your mind when you're writing it, I think, as well. Something to think about.
Yeah, agreed. Couldn't agree more. So I think that's the guts anyway of what's in the report. I guess maybe just to tie it back to the beginning, you know, whole firm risk assessment, you'll have your residual risks and so on. You know, what happens if your residual risk's too high? You know, you mean to be tying that to risk appetite. Mm-hmm. Like, I know I'm singing to the choir here, but what I'm well aware, I'm just about to say the words, I do love a good whole firm risk assessment, but I do love a good whole firm risk assessment because it really is the snapshot of your company, of your operating model. And, you know, you should be able to read it. It should be comprehensible. And as we know, when you're going and doing an audit, one of the first things you do is open up your whole firm risk assessment and see what the current state is. And yeah, it's maybe a bit of a mystifying beast still, but it was good to sort of break it down a wee bit today, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think it's always a good time to go and review your risk assessment. And this analysis, this report by FINMA, could be a good sort of reminder, I think, to go and have another look. Like you say, I think firms should be really making sure, you know, it should be a passion project for an MLRO, really, like building out a really well-functioning, well-designed whole firm risk assessment that would be clear for a third party, for a regulator, and to an auditor as well, obviously, importantly, for people like you and I. Relatively short report as well, in case anyone would be interested in reading that in a bit more detail. There's some things to pull out of there that are useful, whether you're in Switzerland or not. So,
Agreed. And FINMA practicing what they preach, because the to your point, it's quite comprehensible. So the report itself.
Indeed. Cool. All right, then. So I think that's probably us. Anything else to discuss?
No, I think that's pretty much it for me, to be honest. As always, enjoyed this conversation. I think probably only the two of us could, you know, talk 15 minutes about firm risk assessment and really enjoy it, but such is life.
Indeed, we wouldn't be podcasting if we couldn't talk about this in depth. So yeah, no, it's good to go through that stuff. And yeah, a reminder for firms as well, you know, and if you're looking for assistance, you know, reach out to us as well. That's something to consider as well. Look, it's been great catching up again, Evan, and I think we'll say goodbye this time, shall we?
Great. Cheers, Chris.
Thanks. Bye, guys. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Partners in FinCrime podcast. If you want to get in touch with the podcast or for more information on governance, risk and compliance related matters, please reach out on our website at fscom.co or alternatively, send us an email at partnersinfincrime@fscom.co. That's partnersinfincrime@fscom.co.